science and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. Autism hasn't always been well understood. Unfortunately, many times, when a society doesn't understand, it often fears. Lack of quality healthcare and misdiagnosis were common, and those with autism sometimes were even placed in psychiatric hospitals. Today we're talking to someone with autism, a woman named Adler Davin. Adler was not diagnosed with autism until she was 46 years old. Before then, Adler suffered, many times unnecessarily, trying to fit in and trying to manage the overload of senses that assaulted her. But Adler finally found a balance in her life through Zen meditation. Adler also wrote a book about her experiences called Being Seen. Today we're talking about how meditation helped her manage her autism, what it's like to be autistic, and how society and the medical community have come a very long way in helping those with autism. But before we start, I just want to do a quick plug on the podcast. Today we have a few audience members calling in with questions for our podcast guest. You can do this too. Just go to sparkdialogue.com and scroll down to Talk Back to see what we're talking about this week. And you might be chosen to appear in a future podcast episode. And if you haven't rated us yet, please take a moment to do so, whether on iTunes or on Stitcher or wherever else you happen to get your podcast. Your rating really helps. And now let's get on with the podcast. Today we are joined by Adler Davin, author of Being Seen. Adler, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm really grateful to have a chance here. Thanks.
This book that you wrote, Being Seen, is a story about your life with autism. So I know that you have been living with autism for quite a long time, and you actually were only diagnosed with autism as an adult just very recently. So let's go back to your early life. So you grew up in France, and what was it like growing up in France with autism, but not knowing that you actually had something that was called autism?
How was it growing up in France, not knowing? Well, it was feeling strange and not knowing why at all. Something was amiss, you know. Well, when I was a very young child, it was not as bad because, you know, people think, oh, it's cute, you know, you're a child, you know, the differences, your oddness is not as noticeable. But as I got to be like a preteen and a teenager, then it was just awful. Nobody understood. I started to faint at some point, and nobody knew what was going on. And I certainly myself had no clue what was going on.
Right. So as a child, what do you remember standing out to you the most as far as what your experiences were that were a little bit different than what other children go through? So most people have a hard time understanding what exactly it's like to be autistic. Maybe could you describe your perception of your sensory overload or how you interacted with people in social settings?
Yeah, so, well, okay, those two things are extremely, yes, part of the autism. And yes, I had sensory issues already as a child. That's actually one of the major characteristic, in my opinion. When I was in France, I did not like going where things were too noisy. So it was always difficult for my parents to take me in noisy environments. I was doing better when I was in a quiet environment. But I was lucky because I grew up in a relatively quiet environment. I was really lucky because it was a resort town and there were not that, well, in the winter, there were not that many people. I mean, summer was another matter. but also I played tennis, which really for me was very helpful because that is rather quiet. You know, tennis, right. You're alone. You're alone on your half of the court on your turf, you know, you do what you want. So I kind of enjoyed that very much. But socially, yes, I had difficulties with some of my friends, they were no longer my friends suddenly, and I did not know why. Or like I would try to, when I was a teenager especially, I would try to be accepted with the others, and I never was. Well, I mean, almost never. Unless it was on a one-on-one as a group, I was really kind of feeling rejected. And that really hurt.
Right. You actually weren't diagnosed in France, but you ended up at some point deciding to leave France and to come to the United States. Now, why did you decide to leave?
Yeah, well, I felt terrible. I felt the way things in France were set up. Like, for example, you're supposed to work kind of 9-to-5 jobs, and if you don't, there's not many opportunities to, well, at least at that time. You know, that's mm-hmm. a long time ago now. We're talking, I've been in the United States 30 years ago, so things changed.
Right.
You know, France did not feel safe to me. I felt like I did not fit, and I was not a check in the box there. And it's not like it was conscious mm-hmm. all around what I did. I did not consciously knew that I was even different at that time. You know, I just knew that I was very uncomfortable, and so uncomfortable that I found ways to get out of there.
Right. And yeah, it's interesting. Things have changed a lot, both in the United States and
yes.
in France over the last
yes.
few decades. And in a way, I know that you had mentioned that actually not being diagnosed in France was a blessing.
Yes.
What were the viewpoints yes. back then in France about autism, but also about other types of situations like this that are a little bit outside of the norm?
You know, often enough, it's put the person in an institution, okay, very often. Put them
right.
away, you know,
yeah.
put them away. So, and
yeah.
this, you know, this is why I'm so happy to not have been diagnosed as a child, because that's, I'm afraid that would have been the way it would have gone.
Right. So it wasn't at the time incorporated into the educational system. There was no special education for people with
no.
autism or other diseases. Like
no.
That. Yeah.
No. No.
Yeah.
No. There. No. That was totally. No. Put them away and or drug them to no end or, you know, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's too sad of a picture. It makes me very sad to think of, because, you know, it has happened to many people like me, you know, and honestly,
right.
I am no different from some of them. Okay. You know, it's just, I mean, you see, that's what happened. Autistic people are good people. Just, you know, let them get at it their way. Not that, of course, it's always a fine balance between supervision and, you know, I'm not saying not to supervise either. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying just let us be a little bit, you know.
Right, right. So you ended up moving to the United States. So how old were you when you moved?
I was 23 years old when I arrived in the United States.
Okay. Yeah, so moving to another country is always a very brave thing to do, because you have to deal with a new language and a new culture, and things are just so different, and people who've never gone through this don't understand that that change. So what was
true.
It like for you when you moved to the United States originally?
When I first arrived, well, like you said, it was a real shock. I suddenly felt like maybe I could pass, you know, because a lot of people attributed my differences to the fact that I'm French. So that was very nice. I felt like, in a way, there are so many different cultures that being different here in the United States was really, to me, more accepted. I remember lovely things about being able to do things that I could not do so well before. I would go at... if I had, you know, I often had gastrointestinal pains, and I remember being able, of course, to go get some kind of, you know, that pink medicine. that did not even do that much. But anyway, it's kind of menthol to be able to go buy it at 2 in the morning, which, you know, it's unheard of in France. Okay.
Right.
But things like that. The first few years I arrived, it was just a great feeling of freedom, and it was great.
Yeah, that is one special thing about the United States, is that it is very diverse, and for the most part, those diversity is very accepted and celebrated almost.
Yeah, yeah. I just feel like it's kind of also luck of the draw, you know, that this country has so many different cultures. It's like we're kind of forced to make way for other ways if we're gonna get along.
Right.
You know, who knows what other countries would do too under such circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's different, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and so one thing that really impresses me is that you went to go teach in Chicago in a very violent neighborhood. And so as someone who is overwhelmed by things that are loud and noisy situations, I mean, this is very different than the situation you described in your childhood when you're growing up in this very provincial town in France that's very quiet.
Oh, so yeah, it was.
What was that like for you?
Oh, it was a cultural shock, yes. And I have to say, Elizabeth, you know, unfortunately, quite often, the autistic person has to earn money, you know, and often enough, it's the jobs that are difficult that will be more likely to be offered. So I could not manage to, you know, I interviewed so badly and I could not manage to be in a in another type of school. You know, the only schools where they kind of took me on was those very difficult schools. And as a teacher, I did not do so well, of course, with discipline and with the whole class. But what saved me is that I think, looking upon from now, from this vantage point, I see that often enough, actually, my student respected me, especially on the one-on-one, when I had a chance to talk to them. Because, let's face it, Elizabeth, I kind of had an idea what it's like to be different. I mean, but it was nice to meet other people who are also different.
Right.
So we're all very different in various ways.
As time went on, things didn't remain easy for you, though, as you continued to live in the United States.
It came back.
Yeah. How autism affected your life began to get, in a way, worse and worse.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Eventually, listen, I had a child. I love my child like every mom, okay? But it was very, very difficult for me to have a child. And I never had enough money, enough medical, you know, proper medical insurance. I was always borderline with everything. So when my child came in the picture, my sensory problems went through the roof a little bit. They started to really come back in full force, you know, and then I became a single mother and, you know, raising my child really took my whole strengths. I no longer had any strengths left. You know, my weakness became worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. To deal with this, and again, you made another big change in your life and you ended up moving to California.
Yeah.
Why California? What made you decide to go there?
Yeah, well, what made me decide to go to California in the first place was actually, believe it or not, Zen practice. Because for my birthday, when I was in Chicago one time, a girlfriend of mine gave me a book called Nothing Special by Charlotte Jokobek about Zen. And I really liked that book. And I thought, you know, I should really experiment. It sounds like a good system. Mm-hmm. So that's what made me move. I found a Zen center here, and I moved to the Zen center for 6 months. I left my son. That was very, very difficult. But I felt like I had to take care of myself in order to be able to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved into the Zen Center and alone, and indeed it was a tremendous, such a good thing for me. I stumbled upon this practice, and I am so fortunate I did.
Then for people who aren't familiar with Zen, could you describe it? What made it so useful for you?
Yeah, so there is several components, but for me, well, the major one is really Zazen, which is the sitting practice where you sit quietly and still and upright. Mm-hmm. That's quite important for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to practice, like going to a gym, you know. If you do it once, it really doesn't really do that much, but over time, you know, I developed more, longer and longer I sat Zazen, and it's amazing. Now, how does it happen? I do not know, but that slowing down, that stillness is starting to kind of pervade you. And not only that, your life, it's like, okay, you're driving a car and, you know, you have the wheel to keep you on track. Well, that's kind of bringing you back on the right tracks. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And so as you're meditating, do you think of a phrase or a word, or is it just you try to make your mind as empty as possible?
Yes, I am doing what's called Soto Zen practice, and that is totally just no other mantra or nothing, just sitting.
Okay. Yes, I imagine that could actually really help with the sensory overload, is just to put yourself in this very quiet place, even if your surroundings or even if your personal life is sort of chaotic, but you can learn how to put yourself in this very quiet,
yes,
nice
you're totally
place.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's not always, like you say, quiet around. So, you know, I have my earplugs, and at times I've had even some kind of a headgear, helmet on, you know, to block the sound. So, you know, but yes, it's you know, let's face it, and it doesn't cost money if you do it alone.
Mm-hmm. So when you first moved into the Zen Center, you
mm-hmm,
mentioned,
yes.
Did people teach you how to do Zazen, or did you learn in a sort of community setting? Was that part of the ritual every day that you performed?
Exactly, that was what we did every day. Yeah, of course, they kind of show you how to sit at first a little bit. But honestly, you know, how to sit is just being upright and cross-legged. And, you know, I mean, and having maybe a cushion helps, you know. And they show you those things. But basically, you're mostly, yes, you're in a community and you do it every day with others. And it's just beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, so for people who've never meditated, maybe they have a hard time understanding how much meditation can really transform your mind. So are there some examples of things that you used to have a really hard time doing, but now with your Zazen meditations are just so much easier for you?
That's a very good question. Because what has really changed is I think I'm more smiling to others. I am more open to others. I am not as caught into my own problems. I don't feel like that's most important now. I feel others are more important.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole demeanor has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting when you smile, people smile back often enough. Things like that, you know.
As I mentioned to you earlier, there were a few people who actually called in with questions or left some questions for you.
Yes. All right.
The first one is from Barbara. She asks, I have heard that sounds and sensory overload are a problem for those with autism. How has your Zazen, your sitting meditation, helped out with that?
It certainly has. That's for sure. You know, it's kind of like a recipe. You can know it by heart, but this is not from me. Okay, that image. But anyway, the thing I was getting at is that you may know it by heart, have all the ingredients, but until you do it, you really don't know. And saying in words how the meditation actually exactly moves one is impossible. At least that's how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no doubt that I am doing better with sensory stuff. I mean, For example, I've been living in the same location for 13 years now. So that means before I was formally diagnosed, I was already here. And I remember when I, because my sensory problem over 10 years old, 10 years ago were just terrible. I mean, I could not function anymore. So anyway, what I'm getting at is that from my sitting place, which remains the same now, I am going to hear my environment. And I remember I was feeling the vibration. I was inside me when the garbage truck came. I'm just giving you an example. I used to actually feel the vibrations. Well, I no longer do. I no longer do, Elizabeth. How come? Who knows?
I have another question here. She actually left a message.
What was it like when you were diagnosed with autism, and how did you find Zen along the journey of being diagnosed with autism, and how were you treated after you were diagnosed with autism? Thank you very much for your time, and I hope to answer your question. All right, bye-bye.
That was a question from Sarah.
Yeah. So what was it like when I was, let me see if I, because, you know, this is memory stuff for me. when I was diagnosed with autism, it was like being alive again, having a life. It was just great. It just made life happen to me again. And I mean, I don't know again if it ever really did. It was such a great thing to be diagnosed. And then I just found solace, like refuge. Mm-hmm. I could always go back to sitting when I was really upset several times. I would go and try to sit, not that I always was able to, but it was really something to calm me down eventually. You know, it's, I don't want to say that I sat for that reason, because that is not true. You know, you just sit for the sake of sitting. At least that's how it is for me. And then how was I treated after my diagnosis was completely different. People accepted me better. I am not saying again that it's 100% actually, okay? Because it's not. It's very interesting. But, you know, Elizabeth, honestly, my finances got better. And, you know, that is actually the clue to the, the cue to many things in life. Once my finances got better, and also I got better medical insurance, I got better treatment all around. And that eventually totally transformed me.
Yeah. It's interesting that you actually weren't diagnosed right away. It was actually something like 20 some years after you moved to the United States, and 10 years after you started Zen was when you were diagnosed. And you had mentioned better health insurance and better health coverage. And so what actually was that step that they actually were able to diagnose you?
Well, I actually wrote a blog about that not so long ago, saying how it seems like for many autistic people, it's actually very difficult and a very winding, long and winding. And so what happened is, oh, I just want to say before I start that, that it took 23 years to be diagnosed in the United States, which I find very interesting, because it's exactly the same length as how long I lived in France before I came here. So, you know, it's, you can't say that it went faster in either country.
Right.
So anyway, the specific detail is that first I, because of my son, I was on welfare. It was a very difficult decision, but I went on welfare. And so eventually a welfare caseworker saw me faint in front of them, and they did not really believe me yet, but then they sensed that something was amiss. And so they had me seen their own, psychologist and expert, and they realized something was amiss. They could not, of course, diagnose. But anyway, they helped me to get on social security disability. And that was a huge step, because once I was in social security disability, 2 years later, automatically the recipient is enrolled in Medicare. So I finally had a better health insurance, one that allowed me to go see a specialist, you know, on my own without having to be referred. you know, unfortunately, of course, by that time, I mean, I was really getting, it was clear and visible. That's why I got all this help, you know, that I was very ill. So I was no longer able to go out alone that much, you know. So, but again, it's my, you know, everywhere in my life, this is how it is. A Zen friend who is helping me. Mm-hmm. And even though he did not really, really believe me, but he, you know, that's Zen practice for you. He had the integrity to take me to see, you know, a good neurologist, and I was diagnosed. There it is.
Yeah. So in a more general sense, this goes to show you why it's important for people to have good health care. And of course, for a while in this country, we've been debating health care.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's important for people to have good standards of healthcare and medicine, and what would you recommend to society to help make this a little bit easier for people?
Oh, what a big question, Elizabeth.
Yeah, no, no, I mean,
I, you know, I, who am I to say? I mean, I know that every country is trying their best to do this for everybody, you know, and but I just want to repeat, there are many people like me who do not have the financial resources to, or even other resources to see proper medical care. And it's a good thing to help those people out. I am very fortunate that I was finally able to see a specialist. You know, I am very, very fortunate about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And another big thing is education.
Oh, yes.
And I know things have changed a lot. Do you have any recommendations for people as far as education, how to help people with autism?
Yeah, I often get this question, and I don't like to give advice, you know, I really don't. So, but I want to shout to people who are taking care of autistic persons, whether they're children or adults, is to always, always engage the person, give them opportunities, don't shut them down, you know. And even sometimes it takes a village, you know, and sometimes one has to find, say, different lifestyles that are less noisy, less full of sensory input.
Over the course of time, in both France and the United States, the perception of autism has changed a lot. What are some of the biggest things that you've noticed in both these countries?
Obviously, it is better than it used to be. When an autistic person is looking for a job, now they're not right away automatically dismissed always.
Yeah.
They still are, okay? They still are big time. It's a big problem. Mm-hmm. But it's great to have that change in both countries. It's really nice. They, you know, autistic people get hired and everything goes fine. Often, not always, but. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I know you had mentioned you don't like giving advice, but I'm going to ask one more. I was very excited to talk to you because actually a very good friend of mine has an autistic son. And so they are trying to see what the best way is to raise him. Just as we wrap this up, I was just curious if you had any specific advice for particularly parents or also just teachers of autistic children.
Yeah. Have faith, you know. Have faith. You know, many people now, parents, you know, they think that people like me, self-advocates, are, you know, we're not like their child. Well, you know, have faith. You know, it's like wine. Your child is going to grow up. And, you know, you do not know your child always what he's able to do or she is able to do.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. I am very grateful to have had a chance to say those things.
Yeah, and for those of you who are interested, again, Andler's book is called Being Seen, and it's available both in the United States and in French if you want to read it in French. And you can also learn more about her at andlerdavin.com. This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. You can find more information about this podcast at sparkdialogue.com. including ways to appear on the podcast yourself and ask a question, ways to contact us, and previous episodes. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter at Spark Dialogue, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/sparkdialogue. As always, thanks for listening.